you. The left hemisphere loves, it loves to-do lists. It loves checking things off of to-do lists. It likes a to-do list that has really doable items on it that you can get done and feel like, oh, a sense of accomplishment at the end of the day. It's also really kind of detail-oriented with a difficulty in seeing the big picture. So, for example, if you have a friend who's coming over to your house and they call you and they say, can I bring anything? And you go, oh, yes, I'm baking a cake and I need some crescent vanilla flavoring for the cake. And your friend arrives at the house and you say, where's the vanilla? And they say, well, I stopped at a store, but they didn't have that brand. So I didn't bring any vanilla for you at all. That's the left hemisphere. It likes things to be exact. It likes exactness. In contrast to, oh, and it's also really the home of our activity. So it's the part of the brain that engages with the world. So we need it, even though, you know, it really likes checklists and things. We can't throw it out because if you'll begin to march all together. Yes, this is the left. It loves action. It loves to get things done. Yes, and the other really interesting thing about this action thing is it wants to go in the same direction that it was going in. It doesn't want to turn around. It's not open to feedback. The way that the left hemisphere integrates new information is by blaming. It's true. It's like something bad happens, and it goes, whose fault is it? It's obviously perhaps not my fault, or maybe it's all my fault. So the left hemisphere sort of has this incapacity to take in new information, which means, for example, let's use up all the fossil fuels on the planet. Yes, onward. Yeah, it's that kind of an energy. Now, it's contrasted with the right hemisphere. So start milling around a little bit here. Break up your lines and columns. And as you break up now you're actually becoming the long neuron arms of the right hemisphere. The right hemisphere has these long arms so that if Kimberly is connecting with Peter, she's actually able to make a direct connection that includes the input of all of the other neurons across the field. Yeah. It's a very different place. It's a place that goes, oh, vanilla, I will get vanilla. It doesn't matter that it's crescent or not. Of course Sarah needs vanilla for her cake. And I love Sarah. Yes, so there's a capacity here for a complex holding of the world and an understanding of interrelatedness. However, this is the tricky thing about the right hemisphere. It's a very nonverbal place. We'll be learning a bit about what kinds of language awaken the right hemisphere so that we can move into relational space in our language. But most of the language centers are in the left hemisphere. So every time we open our mouth, we're being pulled into the left hemisphere. We're being pulled out of relational space. We're being pulled out of complex space whenever we open our mouths, basically. So the more we know about the kinds of language that encourage complexity, and the more we know about the kinds of language that encourage reductivism, the more chance we have to live a complex life and have complex relationships. So, the last thing I'm going to have you do, I can have you do when you're seated. Let me see if I can remember what it was. So go ahead and go back to your seats. Oh, water for me. Thank you. So the last thing I want to do is give you a chance to look through left hemisphere eyes and right hemisphere eyes. We're actually continually using both hemispheres. We never stop using both hemispheres. The question for all of us really is, where are we locating our attention and where are we locating our intention? How do we intend to see the world? So for the human brain, it can look at other humans in two very different ways. And one of those ways is functional. How can the people that I look at be of service to me or of service to my mission? So just for a minute, imagine that you need to borrow a pen and look around the room to see who has a pen that you can borrow. Okay. Now, kind of wipe that experience out for a minute. And now I want you to know that every single brain in this room has 86 billion neurons. That every single brain in this room is incredibly complex. That even if we are married to somebody in this room, we would not be able to know them. That we just kind of get to approach the shore of their ocean. And now look around the room again and see that these brains are infinite and unknowable and mysterious and magical systems. Do you feel that difference, the way it was to look and see who you could borrow a pen from, and what it's like to look around and go, oh my God, I'm in the middle of miracles. Yeah. So we have a choice at any given moment about how to be in the world, but there's something very tricky about the right hemisphere. And what is tricky about the right hemisphere is that it is the repository of all of the trauma that we have ever lived through. So the problem with the right hemisphere is that if we go into it and we've never been accompanied with warmth and resonance, then it eats us alive. So the experience of moving into the right hemisphere becomes fraught, becomes overwhelmed with the capacity in particular for self-laceration, for self-destruction, for self-criticism, for the self-critical voice to take over. Because when we've lived through any kind of trauma, whether it was in childhood or in adulthood, any kind of trauma that was unaccompanied, where we did not have anyone with us who understood, at least to some extent, what it was like for us to be us, then what's left behind is this sort of brain territory that's essentially cannibalistic. The brain, because we're all located inside of our individual skulls, has a very strong tendency to make sense of bad things by blaming the self. So you remember how the left hemisphere, in order to integrate new information, blames. The traumatized brain, especially brains that have experienced any loneliness before the age of 9, which is most of the world, really, has the tendency to blame the self. If we had an absolutely easy time until we were 9 and then our family fell apart, our brain would be mature enough to start blaming the outside world. And we may find within ourselves a lovely patchwork of self-blame and other blame that has a little bit to do with how old our brain was at the times that bad things happened. So let's talk a little bit about what kinds of language take us into the left hemisphere and what kinds of language take us into the right hemisphere. We already know that blame is one of the major ways to integrate new information for the left hemisphere. if we've had the luck of being very well accompanied, then what our brain does instead of blame is our brain mourns. So for example, I'm in a car, I get a ticket from the police for talking in the US, for talking on my cell phone. It's somewhere between $300 and $400 in the state that I live in. So I get a $300 ticket for talking on the cell phone as I'm driving. The left hemisphere says, God damn it, Sarah, what the hell do you think you're doing? Why do you always do that? Why don't you use the hands-free device? You've got the hands-free device. What are you doing? I can't believe you did that. There's just like this litany of never-ending self-criticism. And if my right hemisphere is on board, my right hemisphere is going, damn, that was painful. Ouch. $300. I could have spent that on something really good. It's kind of a very different feel. There's the mourning. I'm sad that I lost that opportunity. I'm sad that I didn't take the time to plug in the hands-free device, whatever the experience is. So the next major way that the left hemisphere uses language, blame, criticism is another one with blame. The next one is comparison. Comparison. The left hemisphere loves to compare. And so, for example, we're looking around, we're like, who's prettier than I am? Who's younger than I am? Who's in better shape than I am? Who got a better slot as a presenter than I got? You know, that's the voice of the left hemisphere. The right hemisphere, in contrast, is more interested. It's not interested in comparison. It's more interested in what things are like, what do things feel like? In order to begin to experience this, let's see if there's somebody in the room who's willing to help us with this. We may or may not have people who are willing to help. Think of something recent that has happened that you compare yourself about, that you have an experience of feeling like you're not good enough, you're not smart enough, you're not something enough. And let's see how the language changes when we move from the left to the right hemisphere. Okay.
Not brave enough.
Not brave enough to speak.
Scared of going fast. Uh-huh. Scared of things going fast.
Scared of things going
fast. Yeah. Like the car. Like mirrors driving.
So. Acceleration. Aha. When you accelerate, she gets really nervous. Uh-huh. So in that moment, you get scared, but you say to yourself, I should not be scared. Right. I'm not brave enough. Did we understand a little bit? Okay. I saw your hand. We'll come to you in just a moment. So now what we want to know, instead of, what's your name?
Adrian.
Instead of Adrian saying to herself, I'm not good enough. I'm not brave enough. Let's catch a little bit with the right hemisphere what the experience of acceleration might be like for Adrian. So what happens in your body in that moment when you gasp? Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there anything
I
else
gasp,
you notice?
I go tense.
Yeah.
Gasp, go tense. I hold on to something.
Uh-huh. Yes. Uh-huh. Okay, now what we want to do is we want to ask, as she's describing this, what images come to mind for you? Are there any images that come to mind? Do you, if you imagine Adrian gasping and grabbing onto the thing, are you imagining her in Mira's car, or are you imagining her somewhere else? In a roller coaster. So ask her, is it like being on a roller coaster?
Is it like being on a roller coaster?
Does anybody else have any, is it like, any? I had the image of being in a rocket and having the rocket take off and feeling the ignition. Is it like being inside of a rocket? Uh-huh. Anybody else having any images come to your mind? Yeah.
Of being thrown up in the air as a baby.
Oh, wow. 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 Oh, wow. Okay. So now, how is it like? How is it for you now that we've just been coming with you, coming to you with?
Yeah, I feel really understood. It's quite funny.
Ah, and as you think about being in the car with Mira, how is that for you now?
Yeah, it does feel better.
Yeah. So we have not changed the essential situation. We have not changed Mira's driving. But the way that we're catching Adrian is with right hemisphere language. We're catching Adrian with metaphors and with visual images. And in doing this, we're actually accompanying Adrian in a place that she's never gotten to be accompanied before. It's a place when we are comparing ourselves negatively, then what we know is we know that we're in a place where we haven't been caught with what I call resonance. So let me explain resonance for you for a moment. When I turned 50 years old, I thought, what have I not done in my life that I wish I had done? And what I found was that I wished that I knew how to play the cello. I have never played a string instrument, and you may know that the cello has no frets, like a guitar on its thingamajig, whatever they're called. And that they are somewhat difficult to figure out. But I thought, what the hell? No one will ever know. No, I don't have to go play in a symphony. It's not like I'm going to be failing a cello career if I start to study the cello. So I started to study the cello. I travel a lot. And you can't carry a cello with you unless you pay for a ticket on the plane to have it with you. So, but what I discovered in those weeks when I get to be home and be with my cello is I discovered that if you have two cellos beside each other and one of them is being played and one of them is not being played, and you put your ear very close to the second cello, what you do is you can feel the vibrations of that second cello. It's almost like the music that's being played on the first cello plays the second cello so quietly. And we as humans are like this. When I'm sitting beside Kimberly, if I bring my attention to her, then I'm beginning the process of resonance. Daniel Siegel calls this shift of attention to another, he calls this attunement, that I'm beginning to attune to Kimberly. And then, if I know what right hemisphere language is, or if I'm just a natural right hemisphere language talker and I start to use words, then I'm starting to move into a place of resonance. For me, I wish I'd been able to be at this last one, but I was so seduced by the experience of recruitment, and that was really fun. So, but I don't know how they were using the word resonance in resonance cities. But in the way that I'm talking about this, with resonance, there's a yes. Resonance is a two-person system. So if I say, am I getting you? And Kimberly says yes. If I say, am I understanding? And Kimberly says yes. If I say, how is it now? And she says, it's easier. I feel understood, like Adrian did. Then that's a yes. We're moving into resonance. So all of us, as we brought our attention to Adrian, were attuning to her. And then when we made our guesses, is it like this? And she said, I feel understood. Then we as a room were beginning to create a resonant field that Adrian was held in. And it physically changes the brain to be held with resonance. It changes us. So resonance is a two-person system. It starts really early. It starts before language begins. A researcher who I love, who I think about and read very, very slowly, because I find it so sort of horrifying and disturbing at the same time. Her name is Beatrice Beebe. Now, I'm going to describe what she does, and you're going to say, I don't understand why Sarah only reads one paragraph a month of Beatrice Beebe, but I will describe, and you will see what you say. Beatrice Beebe has spent the last 40 years looking at video, very frame by frame, 1/20th of a second at a time, of mothers and babies before the age of 4 months, up to the age of 4 months. And what she's discovered is, will you help me, Kimberly? Come and stand with me. What she has discovered, stand on this side if you're willing. What she has discovered is that in the mother-baby experience, she has a video camera behind me looking at Kimberly, the baby's face, and a video camera behind Kimberly, the baby, looking at Sarah, the mother's face. What she's discovered in this close video contact, it's okay if I touch you, is that the mother, with these 1/20th of a second video frames, is actually acknowledging with her facial expressions whatever happens for the baby. That if the baby's suddenly scared, the mom's face does a scared face with the baby. And the baby has this experience, facial expression to facial expression, of being resonated with, of being understood. It's like the mom's brain is giving the baby's brain a message over and over again of you make sense. So the way that I often talk about this, I take from Daniel Siegel, who talks about the brain in the palm of the hand. He says, this is the spinal column coming up to the brainstem, that the thumb tucked inside represents the deep structures of the brain called the limbic system, and that these fingers that fold down over represent the way that the human cortex comes behind the forehead and scoops in and under and creates fibers that cradle the limbic system. The limbic system is our emotional brain. So with every facial expression that the mother makes that resonates with, that correctly captures a little bit of the baby's experience, with every one of these experiences, the baby's brain is receiving a neural message of, you make sense. That's what the mom's face is saying to the baby's face. The mom's face is saying, yeah, of course you're scared. You make sense. Of course you're sad. You make sense. Of course you're angry. You make sense. That's what the mother's face is continually saying to the baby. This is when The mother's brain is structured with these neurons of attachment. The neurons of attachment run from the prefrontal cortex to nestle and hold the amygdala. So it's almost like the mom's brain is teaching the baby's brain that she makes sense. Babies are born hardwired for alarm and communication. They're hardwired to communicate sadness. They're hardwired to communicate distress. They're also hardwired to communicate joy. And with each of these emotions, the mom's response lets the baby know, yes, this is an emotion that makes sense. Now, depending on the mom's childhood, there might be some emotions that don't make sense to the mom. Because by the time Kimberly the baby is 4 months old, her vocabulary for facial expressions, for emotional facial expressions, becomes exactly what the mother can reflect in those 20th of a second. The baby changes their emotional vocabulary because a baby comes able to express everything. So the baby changes their emotional vocabulary in response to what the mother's emotional vocabulary is. And by the time the baby's 18 months old, when she's out in the world without her mother, she's still carrying an imprint of her mother with her from the experience of making sense. Thank you, Kimberly. So what's really cool is that, of course, being understood deeply by our mothers allows our brains to function very well. But not all of us have had the experience of being deeply understood by our mothers. Maybe our mother had experiences of trauma. Maybe our mother's mother died when she was tiny, or our mother's mother was taken away from her mother and didn't even know how to be with a baby. This, I think, begins to give you a sense of some of the ways that emotional experience and emotional trauma can travel from generation to generation without us even knowing, because, of course, it's happening before words. So I'm just going to sit for a minute because my brain went in a different direction than I expected. So what's really cool, I started that sentence with what's really cool, but then it didn't sound like it was going to be really cool. It sounded like, oh my God, we're in the middle of transgenerational trauma. What's really cool is that these fibers of attachment and neural connection are the fibers that remain the most neuroplastic, the most available for change of any fibers in our human brain. This is our most changeable place. So our experience of holding Adrienne with warmth and resonance actually physically changed her brain. Because it wasn't a place where she'd been held before, and she got to be held a little bit. We, as a group, helped new little neurons grow inside of her brain. And this is one of the things that we do when we use right hemisphere language. So we're going to come now to the next very fun thing that's a different aspect of what are things like for the right hemisphere. And that's impossible dream guesses. An impossible dream metaphor guesses start with, is it like? Dot, dot, dot. Impossible dream guesses start with, would you love it if? And the person I was going to go to, you're leaving. Do you want to do it before you go, or are you on your way out? Oh, dear. And you didn't want to look around and see who could loan you a pen, because we'd use that directly as a... Good. So you've got a pen. Now you had said you had something. You compare it. So it does serve because we're doing impossible dream guesses, and we can't do them without you.
I love you already. What do you want to know?
I want to know when you compare yourself. When did you? What were you thinking of when you raised your hand?
Oh, okay. On the plane ride here from. It was both legs from LA to Philadelphia and Philadelphia to here. I had the experience of not knowing how to use something in the seat I was in, like a light. I didn't know how to switch on. And so I pushed around and I couldn't figure it out. And then the next one was the tray. This tray had a really weird thing. And I couldn't figure out how to get the tray out when the steward said, get the tray out for the food. And I said to her, I don't know how to do that. And she helped me, and she couldn't figure it out either. And she said, a man must have designed this 3 times, because 3 times I couldn't get it out or back in again, and I felt silly. I felt stupid.
So we're going to do impossible dream guesses for Carly. So in an impossible dream guess, it can't be something that actually could happen. Like, you can't say, would you have loved to have changed seats? Because, you know, that could have actually happened. It has to be more impossible than that. So it has to be even maybe a little bit silly. So as you think about, for Carly, being stuck in the airplane seat with these unworkable buttons, what impossible dream guesses do you have for her? Oh, here, we have to mic you so that we can all hear and so that it's on the recording.
So would you love it if they designed it in a way that totally made sense?
Nice impossible dream guess. How about you, Lynette?
I'm not sure I got the question, but here we go. We turn around the plane, we land it, everybody get out, and we get into a plane that has seats that work.
Yes! Yes! Okay, what other impossible?
Finally, my magic finger works.
No matter what. A magic finger that works no matter what.
Would you love it if you could just get that tray out just by thinking about it?
Ah, beautiful. Okay, so now when you think about your plane ride, how are you doing?
Giggling at the silliness and the excitement of having a magic finger.
So fun. And again, we didn't change Carly's experience. We joined her in it. So with our language, it's really, I mean, if you're putting this into the context of integral theory, one of the things you may be thinking about are the quadrants and the way in which we begin alone and then we're moved into the we space. And this movement into the we space is all about resonance with language, a sense of being accompanied, a sense of being understood, and a sense of existing. So I think you maybe started to get a little bit of the impossible dream guesses. The impossible dream guess thing that the left hemisphere tries to do is advice. Whenever somebody is giving you advice, they're in their left hemisphere. When they're trying to fix or explain to you how to think about it differently, so this includes fixing and reframing. Hi. The place I'd like us to go next is with something a little bit experiential. Two exercises that will begin to unfold for you another type of right hemisphere language. The first thing that I'd like you to do is a mini constellation. And to do this, you'll be working in a pair or in a group of three. And Kimberly, would you help me again? what I'd like you to do is to begin to experience another aspect of left and right hemispheres, a way in which the integrated left hemisphere, we can sort of feel, the way we feel the left hemisphere when it's really bringing us good, juicy, yummy things, and a sense of feeling into the right hemisphere and the way that it's bringing us really good, juicy, yummy things. This is an activity that's called the lover and the beloved. So for this activity, you will be inside of your own space. So you may have someone that you love very much or someone that you are the beloved of. But what I'd like you to do is to begin to feel into the internal experience of being both the lover and the beloved. So in our traditional ways of thinking about the lover and the beloved, the lover is approaching. The lover is focused on the other and is approaching. In our traditional way of thinking about the beloved, the beloved is receiving the lover's attention. So this question is a little bit about whether you're willing to be the lover of yourself and whether you're willing to be the beloved of yourself. Are you willing to be the one who loves? Are you willing to be the one who receives from you? We're working a bit with this prefrontal cortex amygdala experience here, because the prefrontal cortex holds the intention to hold the amygdala, the limbic system, with warmth. And there has to be enough of a trust relationship for the amygdala to be able to receive being loved. Both things have to happen for us to truly move into the we space. We both have to be willing to reach out, and we have to be willing to receive. And this is not just an external experience that we have in intimate relationships or friendships. This is also an internal experience. So this is the first step, because, and don't worry about getting anywhere. What I'd like you to do is just find out how much willingness you have. So if for a moment Kimberly is the lover and I'm the beloved, then my question is, this is Sarah, we're working for Sarah right now. In a moment we'll work for Kimberly. But in this experience, I'm wondering what distance really relaxes me. Where do I start to breathe? I start to kind of breathe here, and I can turn toward. If I come closer, I feel my body kind of trying to minimize the distance and the intensity by turning away. So I'd like you each to begin to experience this, and then the next question you'll have, it'll just be fast. It'll be 2 minutes with each type of exploration. So the next exploration will be, Kimberly will be the beloved, and I will be the lover. So again, since it's me we're working with in this moment, my question is, how close do I feel comfortable coming to my beloved? What feels good? Do you feel like coming to me?
It feels like yes.
Oh, so there's an interaction. It's a dyadic experience. There are two. We're moving into we space within ourselves. Does this make sense? That we're starting to look at what is our we space within us? How are we being in relational space even within ourselves? So that her movement brings me closer. Yeah. And then we'd reverse, and then Kimberly would get to be her beloved, and I would be the lover. And you'd see, where do you start and stop breathing? Yeah. And then she would be her beloved, and we did that. And then she would be the lover, and I would be her inner beloved. Is this making a little bit of sense? Okay. Thank you. Four different things. It'll be about 8 minutes total. And then you'll have 2 minutes to talk about it with your partner. And then we'll do something that follows up on this. So if you don't want to do it with a partner, you can do it as a meditation. You can do it even with your fingers. In big auditoriums where people can't move, I have them make one the lover and one the beloved. And see where it feels. So you're welcome to work on your own if it feels a little iffy or if you feel very shy. I often feel very shy when I'm first meeting people at a conference. If you're willing to work in a pair, please stand up. Or if you already know that you have a pair, just stay seated with your partner. And find, yeah, if you're willing to work in a pair, stand up and find a partner. And it can be a group of three, too. Are you looking for a partner? Can I put you with Matt? Okay. So we'll just do this. Notice your breathing particularly. Your breathing will tell you a lot. And I'll give you the timing. I'll just announce it as we go through. So go ahead and begin. Yes. It would be David's lover and David's beloved. And then you'd switch, and it would be Kimberly's lover and Kimberly's beloved. So when you're your lover, she's your beloved. When you're your beloved, she's your lover. Yeah, so notice your breathing. Coming. So the person who is the supporting partner, go ahead and report what's happening in your body as the other finds their place. How is it for you as the person who's working finds their place in relationship to you? Yeah. Yeah. So now in 15 seconds you get to switch and do, and the person A, so if Annette was just working and was the lover, now Annette starts working and is her own beloved. So go ahead and have that first person shift roles.
Thank you.
Okay, now the second person gets to explore. So go ahead and shake it off. And let the other person have a turn being their own lover and then being their own beloved, whichever order they want. Finally, that last, if you haven't done it before, you may have already done it, but just for those people who haven't, the last section of the other lover or beloved for the second person working. So now it seems that people have already spoken a little bit, but I'll give you another minute if you'd like to have some words with your partner about how it was. All right, so now here comes the next thing that you'll actually be doing what I'd like you to experience next in terms of right hemisphere language is what I call relational language. But I appear to have lost my green pen? At the book. Thank you. So the left hemisphere is the hemisphere of I. It's the hemisphere of differentiated, disconnected from the web of life I. And the right hemisphere, once it's been structured with warmth particularly, is the hemisphere of we. For the right hemisphere, the other person exists. Once, you know, if it's not active hell, then the other person exists. So here's I language. So when somebody is telling a story, they, there's a piece that we need before, but I'll put I and you here. We'll do the body sensations next. Okay. I'll just remind myself. The reason that I gave you the task of exploring the lover and the beloved was partly because it's the beginning of a huger exploration, which is how to be in a warm and resonant relationship with the self. Something that in Western Europe and North America, we are not very used to, and even actively discouraged from doing, because we often think that if we're in a resonant relationship with the self, then we're being selfish, rather than having a sense that that's the foundation for everything else. So it's almost like, in the U.S., the early Puritan and Pilgrim morality was you can't think about yourself, you don't speak about yourself, essentially you don't exist except to do good for others and to contribute to the community. That's like the whole ethic that came across in the early days to North America. And it's still, in North America, it's, our communities still really bear this stamp of individualism. But what I wanted you to do was to begin to open that door to what it's like to be warm with the self. But the other thing that I wanted you to do was to step into a relationship of intimacy, which we do not yet have between us, most of us, in this room, because we've all come together for this conference. So the next thing that I'd like you to do is to notice what the dialogue is like between your lover and your beloved. Now, it may have been a beautiful and resonant and easy relationship, in which case there's not going to be very much to talk about. So if you found a rough spot in the lover-beloved relationship, I'd like you to use that relationship as the foundation for the next exercise. If you didn't find a rough spot, then choose a moment of intense conflict between you and somebody else. And it can be an ex-partner or a partner, but what I'd like you to do is to step in to a moment of intimacy that's a difficult moment, and to notice whether the language that you use is I language or whether it's got I and you in it. So this is letting you play a little bit with the way that we move into I language under stress and what kinds of invitations we can give to ourselves and others to move more deeply into relational space. Let me give you this as a demo and then you'll understand a little bit. So the relationship that I'm going to use is the relationship that I discovered in my lover-beloved relationship. So this is Sarah speaking as lover and Sarah speaking as Sarah's beloved. So Sarah's beloved says, I have been waiting for you for a long time. So this sentence has both I and you in it. It's I-you language. It's relational language. The lover says, well, you're just going to have to wait forever. which is, does it have both I and you in it? No, it just has you in it. So now I need to change it. I need to translate it into I and you language. So the way that I might translate it, it'll be different for everybody. The way I might translate it is to say, I don't know if I will ever be able to come for you. To hear how we're already starting to move from the I space into the we space. Is this making sense? Okay, so now, hearing that as the beloved, today, it's kind of sweet, my beloved says, I am willing to wait for you forever. I don't really have a lot of other choices, by the way. The lover says, this is too much pressure for me. Again, there's no you in it. What happens when you enters this language? So the you, if I put you into this language, it would be something like, I feel too much pressure from you. The beloved says, who else have I got? I've got nobody else to pressure. Doesn't have a you in it. Might be, do you understand that we are a unit and that I also exist and that you also exist, but that we're tied together? Are you understanding that we are tied together? And my lover might say, there's sort of a funny kind of settling and relaxation into this dialogue in this moment, and it's like, oh, I'd kind of forgotten that. Yes, I guess we are tied together. I was thinking of myself as totally alone. And I was forgetting our interdependence. Yeah. So are you starting to see how it's two things really that happen when we move out of the I and you language when we're in relational space? One of the things that happens is that we move out of intimacy. We move out of relational space into singular space. And the other thing that happens is that we move into blame. When we move, we can also do blame, with I and you language, but it still stays moving in a really interesting way. So the blame might be, I think you suck. And then this one goes, that's horrible, which is neither I nor you language, but is blaming language. So and then it has to come back to I and you. So just experiment with this and see how it feels. For those of you who study nonviolent communication, you can use your nonviolent communication skills, but what's interesting about nonviolent communication is that it can be intensely non-relational. Because it can be, I feel, I mean, we're so careful with nonviolent communication to avoid blame that we also step out of relationality. So what happens when you take your nonviolent communication language? I feel angry and I'm so wanting respect. Do you hear how we're being very self-responsible, but we're stepping out of the relational space? So it's a little different. It's very interesting. Experiment with it and see how it is with intimacy to remain connected. If blame enters the dialogue, it usually takes two or three exchanges before it subsides. So just watch it and see how it goes for you. What you'll be doing is you'll be working in a pair, but your partner is there not to be one of these people. You're both of them. Your partner is there to give you a reliable sounding board about whether you're getting both I and you into each sentence. Because if you're doing it by yourself, you forget. If there's no witness there, you forget and you'll slip into just singular language. And I want you to have the experience of noticing and translating your singular language into we language. So go back into your, we'll see if there's any questions before I send you back into your pairs. What am I doing here? Okay, go back into your pairs. okay. We just have 5 minutes. So please bow to your, make a little bow to your partner and come back to your seats. And as you come on back to your seats, then we'll just be able to do a little bit just a question or two, I think, is what we have time for, or a noticing. If there were any people that noticed anything, or if this was new to you, how about this? We'll start with this. Did people notice this feeling different as a way to be in dialogue? Okay. So, did anybody have an aha experience that wants to be named? Yes.
So for me, the aha was that I very quickly, within the two or three sentences going back and forth, that the juice and the energy of the criticism, it just dissipated. And I started to feel hopeful. I started to have less of that, you know, sort of dark energy.
Thank you. And then just opening for any questions that anybody has.
So I found it interesting in your example. It felt like the process came to a resolution or coming closer. And I found with my example, it was a lot harder to come to that because it felt like a sort of impasse of not understanding based on my personal example. But the use of the I and you, I echo, felt very much like that that power of raw emotion was sort of pulled away.
Interesting. Yeah. It said it's juicy. I'm like, I'm wanting to go and find out what's the impasse. What can we do with it? So what we've begun to touch on as a group is we've begun to touch on the difference between being in the left hemisphere and being in the right hemisphere, and the way in which the language that we use changes the brains of the people around us and changes our relationship with the world. There are words that take us out of connection with what's really happening. A beautiful one that I just found this morning was the difference between climate change and climate breakdown. Or the difference between species extinction and ecocide. So we have differences in this right hemisphere resonant language, and we also have differences in the directness with which our language interfaces with the world. So we've just gotten a very small chance to dip in, and I hope that it has been of interest to you. It's been a very deep pleasure for me, so thank you. To move towards the right hemisphere. Yeah. Yeah, and to learn about it. Yeah, Sarah. Whatever
you offer.
Oh. Oh, thank you. Thank you. There's a book that Matt is my husband. He's very rarely with me, so I'm feasting my eyes on him. There's a book called Your Resonant Self that came out this fall that's all about. It's all about the relationship with the critical voice inside and how we can change that. It's available on Amazon. It's just been purchased for translation into German. It's also been purchased for translation into Turkish. Yeah. Go figure. And I teach all over the world. I teach in Europe. I teach in Asia. The website. Thank you. Thank you, Matt. The website is the name. The easiest website to find is the one that's the title of the book, yourresonantself.com. And there's free guided meditations for download on the website that are foundational for the book. And so that's how you can find. Yes. And I love constellation work. I teach constellations and do constellations all over the world. I do personal work with people. My calendar is completely full to the end of 2018. Yes. So it's a little hard to get in. But there are folks who study with me who also do private work, and so that's also a possibility. Empathybrain.com. Yes, empathybrain. Empathybrain.com. One word. Empathybrain. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for asking that question. Okay, have a good rest of the workshop, and I look forward to seeing you all throughout the week.